Along with the bad pay, the foot soldiers faced terrible job conditions. For starters, they had to stand on a street corner all day and do business with crackheads. The gang members were strongly advised against using the product themselves, advice that was enforced by beatings if necessary. Foot soldiers also risked arrest and, more worrisome, violence. Using the gang's financial documents and the rest of Venkatesh's research, it is possible to construct an adverse events index of JT's gang during the 4 years in question. The results are astonishingly bleak. If you were a member of JT's gang for all 4 years, here is the typical fate you would have faced during that period. Number of times arrested, 5.9. Number of non-fatal wounds or injuries, not including injuries meted out by the gang itself for rules violations, 2.4. Chance of being killed, 1 in 4. A 1 in 4 chance of being killed. Compare these odds to being a timber cutter, which the Bureau of Labor Statistics calls the most dangerous job in the United States. Over 4 years' time, a timber cutter would stand only a 1 in 200 chance of being killed. Or compare the crack dealer's odds to those of a death row inmate in Texas, which executes more prisoners than any other state. In 2003, Texas put to death 24 inmates, or just 5% of the nearly 500 inmates on its death row during that time. Which means that you stand a greater chance of dying while dealing crack in a Chicago housing project than you do while sitting on death row in Texas. So, if crack dealing is the most dangerous job in America, and if the salary is only $3.30 an hour, why on earth would anyone take such a job? Well, for the same reason that a pretty Wisconsin farm girl moves to Hollywood. For the same reason that a high school quarterback wakes up at 5 a.m. to lift weights. They all want to succeed in an extremely competitive field in which, if you reach the top, you are paid a fortune, to say nothing of the attendant glory and power. To the kids growing up in a housing project on Chicago's South Side, crack dealing was a glamour profession. For many of them, the job of gang boss, highly visible and highly lucrative, was easily the best job they thought they had access to. Had they grown up under different circumstances, they might have thought about becoming economists or writers. But in the neighborhood where JT's gang operated, the path to a decent, legitimate job was practically invisible. 56% of the neighborhood's children lived below the poverty line, compared to a national average of 18%. 78% came from single-parent homes. Fewer than 5% of the neighborhood's adults had a college degree. Barely 1 in 3 adult men worked at all. The neighborhood's median income was about $15,000 a year, well less than half the U.S. average. During the years that Venkatesh lived with JT's gang, foot soldiers often asked his help in landing what they called a good job, that is, working as a janitor at the University of Chicago. The problem with crack dealing is the same as in every other glamour profession. A lot of people are competing for a very few prizes. Earning big money in the crack gang wasn't much more likely than the Wisconsin farm girls becoming a movie star or the high school quarterbacks playing in the NFL. But criminals, like everyone else, respond to incentives. So if the prize is big enough, they will form a line down the block just hoping for a chance. On the south side of Chicago, people wanting to sell crack vastly outnumbered the available street corners. These budding drug lords bumped up against an immutable law of labor. When there are a lot of people willing and able to do a job, that job generally doesn't pay well. This is one of four meaningful factors that determine a wage. The others are the specialized skills a job requires, the unpleasantness of a job, and the demand for services that the job fulfills. The delicate balance between these factors helps explain why, for instance, the typical prostitute earns more than the typical architect. It may not seem as though she should. The architect would appear to be more skilled, as the word is usually defined, and better educated, again, as usually defined. But little girls don't grow up dreaming of becoming prostitutes, so the supply of potential prostitutes is relatively small. Their skills, while not necessarily specialized, are practiced in a very specialized context. the job is unpleasant and forbidding in at least two significant ways: the likelihood of violence and the lost opportunity of having a stable family life. As for demand, let's just say that an architect is more likely to hire a prostitute than vice versa. In the glamour professions, movies, sports, music, fashion, there's a different dynamic at play. Even in second-tier glamour industries like publishing, advertising, and media, swarms of bright young people throw themselves at grunt jobs that pay poorly and demand unstinting devotion. An editorial assistant earning $22,000 at a Manhattan publishing house, an unpaid high school quarterback, and a teenage crack dealer earning $3.30 an hour are all playing the same game, a game that is best viewed as a tournament. The rules of a tournament are straightforward. You must start at the bottom to have a shot at the top. Just as a major league shortstop probably played little league, and just as a grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan probably started out as a lowly spear carrier, a drug lord typically began by selling drugs on a street corner. You must be willing to work long and hard at substandard wages. In order to advance in the tournament, you must prove yourself not merely above average, but spectacular. The way to distinguish yourself differs from profession to profession, of course. While JT certainly monitored his foot soldiers' sales performance, it was their force of personality that really counted, more than it would for, say, a shortstop. And, finally, once you come to the sad realization that you will never make it to the top, you will quit the tournament. Some people hang on longer than others. Witness the graying actors who wait tables in New York. But generally, people get the message quite early. Most of JT's foot soldiers were unwilling to stay foot soldiers for long after they realized they weren't advancing, especially once the shooting started. After several relatively peaceful years, JT's gang got involved in a turf war with a neighboring gang. Drive-by shootings became a daily event. For a foot soldier, the gang's man on the street, this development was particularly dangerous. The nature of the business demanded that customers be able to find him easily and quickly. If he hid from the other gang, he couldn't sell his crack. Until the gang war, JT's foot soldiers had been willing to balance the risky, low-paying job with the reward of advancement. But as one foot soldier told Venkatesh, he now wanted to be compensated for the added risk. "Would you stand around here when all this shit is going on? No, right? So if I gonna be asked to put my life on the line, then front me the cash, man. Pay me more, 'cause it ain't worth my time to be here when they're warring." JT hadn't wanted this war. For one thing, he was forced to pay his foot soldiers higher wages because of the added risk. Far worse, gang warfare was bad for business. If Burger King and McDonald's launch a price war to gain market share, they partly make up in volume what they lose in price. Nor is anyone getting shot. But with a gang war, sales plummet because customers are so scared of the violence that they won't come out in the open to buy their crack. In every way, war was expensive for JT. So why did he start the war? As a matter of fact, he didn't. It was his foot soldiers who started it. It turns out that a crack boss didn't have as much control over his subordinates as he would have liked. That's because they had different incentives. For JT, violence was a distraction from the business at hand. He would have preferred that his members never fired a single gunshot. For a foot soldier, however, violence served a purpose. One of the few ways that a foot soldier could distinguish himself and advance in the tournament was by proving his mettle for violence. A killer was respected, feared, talked about. A foot soldier's incentive was to make a name for himself. JT's incentive was, in effect, to keep the foot soldiers from doing so. "We try to tell these shorties that they belong to a serious organization," he once told Venkatesh. "It ain't all about killing. They see these movies and shit, they think it's all about running around tearing shit up. But it's not. You've got to learn to be part of an organization. You can't be fighting all the time. It's bad for business." In the end, JT prevailed. He oversaw the gang's expansion and ushered in a new era of prosperity and relative peace. JT was a winner. He was paid well because so few people could do what he did. He was a tall, good-looking, smart, tough man who knew how to motivate people. He was shrewd, too, never tempting arrest by carrying guns or cash. While the rest of his gang lived in poverty with their mothers, JT had several homes, several women, several cars. He also had his business education, of course. He constantly worked to extend this advantage. That was why he ordered the corporate-style bookkeeping that eventually found its way into Sudhir Venkatesh's hands. No other franchise leader had ever done such a thing. JT once showed his ledgers to the board of directors to prove, as if proof were needed, the extent of his business acumen. And it worked. After 6 years running his local gang, JT was promoted to the board of directors. He was now 34 years old. He had won the tournament. But this tournament had a catch that publishing and pro sports and even Hollywood don't have. Selling drugs, after all, is illegal. Not long after he made the board of directors, the Black Disciples were essentially shut down by a federal indictment, the same indictment that led the gangster named Booty to turn over his notebooks to Venkatesh, and JT was sent to prison.